Hi, everybody, and welcome to Neuroscientist Talk Shop, UTSA's Neuroscience Research Podcast. Today is February 22nd, 2024, and we're talking with Janko Gospodarczyk. I knew I would blow it, Gospodarczyk. Okay, I've got it that time. And Janko is the assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry and Green Center for Reproductive Biology Sciences at UT Southwestern University. And his work is on control of gene expression and pathways for changing gene expression in brain plasticity, social behavior, and aging. Some of his work has focused on changes in gene expression brought about by and also as a cause of changes in social status in ants. And in those, social status is super important, even in deciding lifespan. And so this work intersects with the entire field of longevity. I hope we'll talk about that some. A little bit. Hi, Janko.
Hi, everyone.
Also with us is Lacey Barton.
Hi.
Lacey is an expert on germ cell development, which at first sounds kind of different from ant behavior, but we'll see.
There's
some,
a little.
We'll see some place of intersection. So, hi. Thanks for joining us, Lacey.
Hi. Thank you.
And Alexei Sochnev, who's our resident chromatin biologist and epigeneticist. Hi, Alexei.
Hi.
And me, I'm Charlie
nice
Wilson.
Here.
So, Janko, most of us know that in ant colonies, every individual ant has some kind of role, and they have a remarkably different phenotype. You can kind of tell which kind of ant they are just by looking at them, and they're born into that role, and they cannot change it. And so it's not too surprising to us. We see all these different kind of ants, and we think, well, they were born that way. But you've been studying an amazing ant species, the Indian jumping ant. And those ants, the ant types exist, but individual ants are not stuck permanently in their roles, but sometimes get the opportunity to compete in a kind of dance contest, the winner of which undergoes a transformation from worker ant to queen. And that transformation is a huge change. They change in every way. They get bigger. They become reproductively active. The other ants begin to submit to them. They dominate the other ants, and their life expectancy increases several fold. Could you start by just telling us about the social life of these ants and what I just said, only really?
Yes, I mean, they are very fascinating ant species. In general, in the majority of the other ant species, colonies usually consist of only single queen and then of thousands and thousands of sterile workers. And if you are a queen or a worker, it really depends on the social cues that you get from your sisters during the larval development. And once when that development is set, you cannot really change the caste anymore. And that's actually very good strategy because of this social division, the ants are the most successful group of insects in the world. There is more ant species than mammals and birds combined, and there is more ants by biomass than people on Earth. But it has also its downsides. So if the queen dies, usually the whole colony dies out because they don't replace the queen, the main reproductive in the colony. And in that sense, my species is very unique because if the queen dies or we remove it from the colonies, the workers know that the queen is not there. And then after a couple of days, they start this dancing tournament. And whoever wins that dancing tournament becomes a new queen called Gamergate in this case. And not only that it activates reproduction, but it changes other physiological phenotypes. So they completely change behavior. They become the most dominant ant in the colony. They change metabolism, and now they age much slower than they would age as the workers. And then in this species, the workers live only for around 200 days, where the gamergates live more than 6 years. So it's huge difference that in the same sex, in the same species, you have such a different phenotypes, but it makes very interesting. And it's one of the rare species where plasticity is kept for the rest of their life. So at any moment of in their life, they can actually switch to the gamma gate. And it works also in the other direction. So if you cause social defeat, they can completely switch back to the worker caste. And they completely again change the metabolism, rewire the brain, and now they live much shorter than they would live as workers. So they have all these very cool phenotypes, but now we are trying to understand what are molecular mechanisms and pathways behind those phenotypes and plasticity.
So it's an adult, so it can't just go back and undergo the whole developmental process that led to it being the kind of ant that it is. It has to just completely restructure itself as an adult. It's not really a developmental shift the way we think of these things as being developmental.
No, because we don't really have many new cells during this process. We actually restructure already existing cells, at least when we are talking about the neurons. So we don't get new neuronal populations. What we get is completely restructuring of the transcriptional landscape when it comes to the neurons. So it's a very nice model to study what are interactions between, gene regulation, social behavior, and how one actually modulates the other in both directions.
It seems to me that changes in the nervous system, even though the changes in behavior are enormous, and actually the ant looks completely different, but the is so much larger. But the changes in the nervous system are a little bit subtle. The morphology of the nervous system in general.
Oh, in our ants, the morphology actually doesn't change. So the morphology is the same, because the ants, how they grow, they only grow during the larval stage. So there is So basically your body plan is fixed after that.
So normally a queen would be larger, but
yes,
in this case...
Yes, it would be, exactly. In this case, it stays the same size. Uh-huh. For that really large queen, that is set during the larval development.
And so being how queen much is all in your head, basically, in this for this
yeah. ant. Exactly. So basically, they are very, very unique ant species. Very few ants can actually change their caste in such a way as these ants. So it makes them very appropriate for molecular studies, because potentially you could make all different genetic lines and mutants and transgenics that it's not possible in other ant species.
So what's really powerful about this, I think, is that you have the ability to sort of track down all the changes, and you've seen a couple of steroid hormones that are key in deciding this. Could you tell us about those?
Yes, so there are two hormonal axes that regulate caste phenotypes in this case. So we have adrenal hormone that is more which components are more present in the workers and regulate workers-like behavior. And then we have ecdysone, that it's a steroid, and that regulates more gamma gate behavior, queen-like behavior. And that's interesting from also from in general mammalian perspective, because steroids play a very important role in regulating social hierarchies. So it seems independently, to different social sort of structures, they use the same building blocks to actually modulate social hierarchies.
Yeah, I'm sort of trying to picture what a steroid hormone would do to make a switch like that. So one of the things about steroid hormones is they penetrate into the cell, they bind intracellular receptors, and then they can go off into the nucleus and do things.
Yes, so basically when the hormone is bound to receptor, the receptor translocates in the nuclei, and then they have this very interesting way of acting in the nuclei, where on one hand they can open chromatin and prepare genes for the transcription, but on the other hand they can also in the same cell close the chromatin and repress gene expression. So in this case, having two different hormones regulate which genes will be expressed in the workers and which genes will be expressed in the congregates. And that's how they regulate this huge plasticity, brain plasticity.
It's very coordinated, I guess, because there are really a lot of genes that are being affected, or at least a lot by my count. Maybe you're used to thinking about vast numbers, but these things are, each of these hormones is regulating a lot of different genes that do a lot of different things. And they're just the right set.
Yes, that's actually correct. So on one hand, you have genes that they're regulating directly by transcription. On the other hand, you have sort of a much larger set of genes that are regulated how the chromatin is regulating. So you need to have, they make accessible chromatin for other transcriptional factors to actually drive transcription. So they basically act sort of locally, but also more globally on DNA. So, and that's what is uniqueness for steroid hormone receptors.
So these receptors are managing it, but are they constantly monitoring, constantly controlling? The minute you, if a little fluctuation in the hormones and the animals role could shift really quickly?
Yes, so they actually switch really fast in like, in an hour you get really complete changes in the gene expression. But itself, it's controlled by the presence of the and the levels of the hormone, but also on the transcriptional level, it's controlled by expression of the receptors. For example, the gamma-gate hormones actually drive higher levels of juvenile hormone receptors to make them more sensitive to juvenile hormone and to social defeat in this case. And it's vice versa. Certain aspects of the ecdysone receptor complex are much are under regulation of juvenile hormone, makes them more sensitive to ecdysone in workers. So there is really this tight control on really multiple layers how their transcription and their sort of signaling works in the end brain.
So there are a couple of different kinds of questions that come up in my mind. One of them comes up first, and I sort of want to suppress it a little bit because it's to immediately say, whoa, what determines social behavior? And so what's changing in the neurons? And then there's this very complicated relationship between the gene expression and behavior, which for every different aspect of behavior might be a slightly different thing. Do we know that? Can we track that stuff down?
In short, no. So it's we don't know. But yes, so on one hand, changes in transcription can drive different behavioral outcomes, but also the behavior, especially social interactions, can be a very powerful driving force behind the changes in gene expression. For example, in social defeat can completely change sort of the gene transcription landscapes in neurons. So sort of it works both ways. What comes first and what comes next is very difficult to disentangle right now. So I think that it's combination of both sides of the spectrum.
So social status in the colony is probably partly stabilized by the way the other ants treat you. You become dominant, and they treat you.
Yeah, especially in this species, sort of it's more important who you know and who are your friends in the colony, and those really make you a higher status. Where in the other species, it's completely set developmentally, so it's up on your sisters to make you a queen or a worker. So it really depends on your relatives. Where here, you rely on your friends, I guess.
The amazing thing about it, maybe there are many things about it that are curious, but the one that shocks me the most is the effect on longevity. Because we sometimes act like our social lives can affect our longevity, but we don't mean it the way it's meant in these ants, where it might be several factor of four or five in length.
So it's very extreme. So in this species, the workers live only like 200 days, and the gamma gates can live up to 6 years. So it's a huge difference in aging. What is more fascinating, that if you have a old worker and if you switch it to the gamma gate, it can completely rejuvenate and it looks like much younger ant. And that's very unique for this ant species. And it also opens a lot of interesting questions, and maybe we can find some factors that regulate this rejuvenation and try to apply it to model of neurodegenerative diseases in mammals and to see if we can save some phenotypes or reverse some phenotypes that come from the disease progression.
So I'd like to hear what it is for a cell to be young, what it means, and how we can tell.
One day maybe I can answer that question, but now it's all unknown.
But we look at it, but you can look at cells and say, this cell looks like a young cell, or this. Is that not true? Why?
Yes, so there are certain hallmarks of aging, like loss of heterochromatin, activation of repetitive elements, and those are conserved in all animals. But it's very unique in this end that they can reverse these hallmarks of aging. And that's something that it makes it really interesting for broader understanding of aging, not only aging in ants.
So aging, at some level, aging is the accumulation of epigenetic changes?
Yes, and cell damage, and how you sort of rejuvenate that is very, actually...
Cell damage sounds like a hard thing to reverse. The epigenetic changes maybe not so hard, because those scientists undo those all the time in the laboratory, don't they?
The epigenetic change?
Really, in the context
really.
Of a whole organism.
Yeah, it's you can do it in the individual cells, but on the whole organism, it's very rare, I would say. But we have more chromatin persons.
Besides, we would do one thing at a time, and what happens with aging is, about 50 different things get affected, and to reverse all 50 using a single treatment is not possible, to my knowledge, but perhaps one day.
The cell isn't required to just use one treatment, one reagent to do it. It could be doing it.
Once you start putting...
I think that, if you have that damaged organelles, if you don't have proper transcriptional response that you can actually replace the damaged proteins, then you will not revert those type of aging phenotypes. But if you manage to restructure your sort of transcriptional landscapes that look much younger, you can actually recover certain cell damage. It is more fascinating that in this case, neurons still stay neurons. There is no differentiation, and that's something quite unique, because usually for such a huge scale of rejuvenation, you usually go through the stage of pluripotency, like with induced pluripotent stem cells, but in this case, you still preserve function of neuron as a neuron, and that's actually quite unique.
Very interesting. So in your system, can you hasten aging? So if you go from a gamma gate and then it gets demoted to back to a worker?
Yes, so that's very interesting. It depends when you cause these types of social defeat. Mm-hmm. So if you cause it in the young gamma gates, and they switch to worker, yes, they will change the metabolism and they will age faster than they would at the gamma gate, but they still age at rate of normal worker.
Okay.
But it's more fascinating if you revert very old gamma gate, when it would not live anymore at that age as a worker, then we see sort of signs of enhanced aging. And we see that, what means that there is some kind of mechanism to track their real age, and they live only very short, only for a month or so.
That's amazing. Sort of Portrait of Dorian Gray kind of a thing. It would have lived a lot longer. You wouldn't have seen those signs of aging. So what are the signs of aging in the worker that are you just noticing that it dies?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very similar. Like in the flies, you can see, you know, less mobility, less orientation. And then on the chromatin levels, you see loss of heterochromatin. You see the transcription of repetitive elements. And, you know, there are different sort of ways how you describe the aging process.
So, Lexi, tell us what it means, loss of heterochromatin, because it's not like you're losing your DNA. What are you losing when you lose
heterochromatin? DNA is still there, but typically DNA is partitioned, you know, in the textbook sense, into this euchromatin, which is transcriptionally active regions, and heterochromatin, which is condensed, compacted regions in the nucleus. And the prevailing thought these days is that in the young cells, in healthy, happy cells, this partition is very high fidelity. Their boundaries are tight. If you profile 100 cells at the young age, then you will very clearly see that each of these 100 cells has heterochromatin here and euchromatin here, and these domains really are nicely organized and neat. Like, consider you just moved into a new house, and all the furniture is clean, and your kitchen's clean, and everything is just like nice and shiny. And then consider a fridge that you've had for like, you know, 10 years, right? And somewhere in the back there's a stain, and somewhere like in the vegetable drawers there's like chunks of onion that are like stuck at the bottom there. And like, I don't know why I know all this, but I somehow do. And basically that's what happens with nuclear organization during aging, when these domains just cell to cell becomes a little different. You know, somebody has stickers on their fridge, somebody has magnets, somebody doesn't have a fridge anymore.
So the chromatin that's available for use, is it turning into unavailable, or unavailable turning into available, or that
it's very hard to say. It's all still there, but like where you started out with all 100 cells being in the same place, acting the same way, responding the same way to the stimuli, as the aging goes on, just stochastically, some of these cells drop out, some of these chromatin domains drop out, and you just end up with like a peloton in a bike race, right? Started out all together, ended up stretched over 10 miles of a highway.
And the thing we're measuring that's separating is that it is the expression of some gene or some set of genes?
Yeah, we can look at gene expression. We can look at, you know, localization of histone marks. There's numeric quantitative metrics for this.
So All of these have to do with gene expression, though, right? Because the nucleus has its job.
So very often is, you know, how the chromatin is structured tells you what is your cell identity, if you're neuron cells or muscle cells. So with aging, when you lose this sort of boundaries of the chromatin, very often you have mis-expression of the genes. You suddenly start to have genes expressed in the old cells where it should not be expressed. And that can really influence badly on the cell function. So suddenly, if you have genes that would be usually expressed in the muscle cell, and now they're expressed in the neurons, so it can be very tough for the neurons still to maintain their proper neuronal function. And I think that's where it comes when you restructure that chromatin that looks younger. You basically put back the gene expression how you started, so the cell identity becomes again fixed. It's not anymore so disorganized.
I would add to that also that at the steady state, you might not notice too many gene expression changes. But if you introduce a strong stimulus, for example, you know, neuronal stimulation, they have to talk to each other, they stimulate each other, then the fidelity of response changes.
Ah, so what's the molecular mechanism of that? I mean, where is that change happening? Is it actually in the gene expression machinery, or is that in the intracellular signaling machinery that's supposed to?
I think the answer is all of it.
Yeah, it's everywhere. So even changes in metabolism will cause the changes how your chromatin is regulated. So everything is very tightly controlled.
So in this ant where the cells, basically the nervous system, lives so much longer, what's happening? These are accumulation of errors and things running down. They get undone somehow.
So we are hoping to really discover what is happening and how they can rejuvenate. But for now, we don't really know how that is. And that's sort of the beauty of the system, because whatever we touch, everything is new. And we are looking right now, try to find the factors that actually are responsible for this rejuvenation.
Seems to me it's encouraging that the ant can do it. I mean, from listening to you guys talking about the mechanism, it just sounds like, oh, everything runs down and there's no one particular thing, and there's no system to it, which means that there's no system for fixing it. But somehow the ant does reverse it.
Yes, and that's the fascinating thing about this ant, because they can do it. Usually, even other ant species are not available. They cannot repair the aging phenotype.
I'm not trying to come up with some kind of longevity snake oil. I know there's been a fad, and you guys are probably all sort of reacting to that. It what?
I don't think it's a fad. I think it's a NAD.
What's that mean?
It's a joke. I'm making joke about fad being one of these cofactors in the cycles, and NAD being another cofactor in the cycles. You know, you can buy NAD injections.
Yeah, there are a million things that people say. It was very popular a few years ago, at least among the brilliant billionaires of Silicon Valley, to try to put money into it.
I think that's my sort of the driving force behind looking in the aging. It's not to slow down aging or to reverse aging, but it's more when we go to the pathological aspects of aging, that we all age more in a healthy way. So if you have certain neurodegenerative diseases, understanding this normal aging processes and in the end how they rejuvenate could actually maybe help in treating certain disease states instead of making everyone live for 100 years or something. At least for me, the driving force is not to make people internally young. It's more to actually help people to age more healthy.
So in that note, a lot of neurodegenerative diseases involve mitochondrial dysfunction.
Yes.
And so can you tell us anything about what's happening in ants related to mitochondrial genes?
So we didn't actually look directly into mitochondria, but we see that sort of genes that are responsible for different metabolic changes also change in the gene expression. So for example, we see more OXPHOS genes go up in the workers, where more glycolysis genes go up in the gamma gates. And all these genes are implicated in, you know, with more OXPHOS, you get more reactive oxygen species, what mean more DNA damage and more lipid damage. So if you have less OXPHOS, most probably you get less damage and you age slower. So, but we still didn't look completely how mitochondrial function is. What is the difference in the mitochondrial role between the two different castes? But it's on my list to look at.
Your species is unique and among ant species in this plasticity.
Yes.
Has anybody done any comparative genomics to see if there's like duplication somewhere that gave them this ability?
So that's a very good question. Yes, people looked at different sort of aspects. So what is interesting, what is unique about this species, like you mentioned, it's plasticity, but in majority of the ant species, this different aging rate between the queens and workers is conserved. It's just that this determination happens very early in development. And once when it's set, you cannot change it. That's the difference. But in this slower rate of aging, it's conserved between the species. Mm-hmm. Plasticity is something unique.
What's interesting is that this, the aging is concerned not just within ants, because the termite queen, which is as far removed from ants evolutionarily as humans are removed from ants, almost.
Like, yeah.
It's a really distant relative, right? They also live like years and years.
Yeah, also what is fascinating when we are talking about hormonal regulation, even in the, like you said, in very distant eusocial species, they again use the same building blocks. So juvenile hormone signaling and egg dyson play a very important role in Cas determination. So it seems that every time when you go through sociality, you start to use the same building blocks. And termites are fascinating for other reasons. For example, their DNA methylation that is also present in ants, but in termites, it's more similar to humans than DNA methylation in ants. And for example, flies don't have DNA methylation. So ants also have interesting, when we talk about neuroscience, you know, certain aspects are very interesting in ants because in comparison to flies, not only DNA methylation, but for example, homolog of oxytocin still exists in ants, where it's completely missing in flies. And the question is, does it have the same role in social bonding in ants as in mammals? We don't know yet. But it is expressed in the brain.
Well, I think we can expect maybe not to live longer, but to have a more interesting life the more we know about the ants.
And their social. I agree with that.
So thank you very much, Janko. And
thank you for having me.
That's great.
Lacey.
Thank you.
And this has been Neuroscientist Talk Shop.